I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, you're listening to The Future of Media Explained with me, Press Gazette Editor-in-Chief Dominic Ponsford. This week, we're hopefully going to learn all about how publishers can survive a tsunami of advertising disruption. So, joining me on the podcast sofa this week is our editor at large, if you will, or sort of investigations writer, Jim Edwards, former editor-in-chief of Insider, or Business Insider, as it used to be. And he's, over the last couple of months, has been investigating quite deeply around what I've called a sort of tsunami of disruption when it comes to online advertising. There's a huge amount going on, and most of it is not very good for publishers, with the result that we've seen thousands and thousands of jobs lost in the UK, in the US, over the last year. So there's been an economic downturn, which doesn't help, but issues have really been compounded by some changes in the way ad tech works, and also by some changes in reader behaviour, which is a sort of generational shift towards social media and towards video. With advertisers following. And also, Press Gazette would argue, I think with some evidence, we feel that the internet is increasingly rigged in favour of a few dominant tech platforms who, if we're not careful, are going to squeeze the life out of journalism funded by advertising on the open web. So, without further ado, let's open up the discussion between myself and Jim Edwards. You were at Insider from 2011, and that was around the time, you know, from memory, Insider was doing well, you know, Vice was doing well, BuzzFeed News, RIP, was doing well. So it was a time when the online advertising market seemed to support quality journalism in a way it doesn't do quite so well now. So what was going on at that time that's a bit different from what's going on at the moment?
So the environment online has changed completely. Like, the internet today is a different beast, basically, from what it was in 2011. And in 2011, you had all browsers had cookies, including Safari, which is Apple's browser. Chrome was a big one. Microsoft Internet Explorer was a big thing back in the day, although no one uses it anymore. And so it was a cookie-rich environment, and you did not need a lot of ad tech to hook that up to your site as a publisher and invite ad buyers on the internet, these demand-side platforms, to target your users who were looking at, you were offering news for free, and these advertisers would target your users based on their anonymous internet usage history. And you could make a pretty good living at that, actually. Initially at Insider, you know, we sold advertising direct to people, you know, like the old fashioned way, like premium direct, you know, making deals with people for sponsorships, that kind of thing. And then piece by piece, we added increasingly sophisticated ad tech. So we had a real-time bidding business for remnant inventory, you know, like pieces of inventory on the site that weren't otherwise sold. We added a programmatic business. That, you know, brought in even more money. Then we had, we added a thing called, was it header bidding, which is like just an even more sophisticated way of winning ad auctions in Google. And then we brought in advertising yield optimizers, you know, people whose job it was to just sort of sit watching the yields and trying to move our prices up and trying to get rid of certain bad advertisers who we didn't want on the site. And it turns out that if you do all these things and you add all these things one by one, there was a really good business there, as long as you had a really large audience. So there were several other things going on. You know, Facebook was interested in news material that went viral. And so was Twitter to an extent. And LinkedIn was for a period as well. And then Google was encouraging everyone to optimize all of their content for search, so that if you wrote a story and fixed the post up in the correct way about a topic, if you were on the first search result page of Google, you would get a huge amount of incoming traffic. And all this existed in a sort of virtuous cycle. Publishers could provide news for free. They had places to go to get traffic, Google and Facebook and other places. And then they had this ad tech mechanism to monetize all this, and advertisers would fund it. And this was a great business. But in the last couple of years, really, it's actually a very recent change. Google has dialed down the importance of news in its search engine results. So Google is simply sending less traffic to news websites and is using news websites less often as a source for its information than it used to. Facebook has done the same thing. Facebook has largely walked away from news. It used to be, Facebook used to prioritize news. And this was in the Trump era when, if you remember your Facebook feed in the Trump era, it was full of like very angry people. And Facebook was often not a fun place to be. Now your Facebook feed is filled with your close friends and relatives, and there's probably very little news in it. So Facebook dialed back news. It got rid of its actual news tab. It ended its partnerships with publishers. And then at the same time, and I have a distinct memory of the first time I came across this, because it was during the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. I attended a meeting at Business Insider where someone said, you know, you're covering the coronavirus thing very, very intensely. And I was like, yeah, we're doing dozens of stories a day. It's a huge global story, obviously, particularly in March and April of 2020. And they're like, are there other types of news we can cover that are less negative and less doomy? And the genesis of this question was that a huge number of our advertisers at the time had basically said, we are not advertising next to anything with coronavirus in it. And so the question went out, you know, can we produce other types of content that advertisers might actually monetize against? And the problem for a news division is that the answer to that is kind of no, you know. You know, the biggest story on the planet was the pandemic. We couldn't just like not write about it.
I suppose if you start from the premise that you're covering the news of the most important things going on at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other frustrating thing about it was that a huge part of our news package was trying to give people good advice about how to stay healthy. You know, like stay out of crowded rooms. Don't get on the bus if you don't have to. You know, does a mask work or not? That kind of thing. And advertisers just said, we don't want to be near this. Now, since that time, advertisers have increased their like list of banned words and topics. And my understanding is that some of these blacklists are thousands of words long and capture huge swathes of types of information. But a lot of advertisers just say no to news now. Like a lot of advertisers are like, we want no politics. We want no Ukraine, no Russia, no Gaza. No COVID, nothing controversial, no Trump. And once you take all of that content, you know, if that content is blocked to advertisers on news websites, then a lot of news websites don't have a lot of material left. So there's been this pullback by Facebook, a pullback by Google, a pullback by advertisers themselves. There's a few peripheral things going on. You know, Elon Musk has changed Twitter so that it's no longer a great environment for news. Threads is a bit like Twitter, but it's just not big enough to make a difference. And you couple that with there's yet another change in the environment, which is that people read news on their phones largely. Something like 90% of the news audience is on a phone for many publishers. But people don't read headlines on their phones anymore. They're looking at TikTok and they're scrolling through video, or they're looking at Reels on Instagram and they're scrolling through video. And it's the same with Snapchat. They're scrolling through video. They're not looking at headlines. They're not even looking at text. So if you have written a story, very often you made a huge mistake because you should not have written it. It's already in the wrong medium because there is no medium. You know, TikTok doesn't display text and Snapchat doesn't display text in a editorial format that we would understand. And that's where particularly young people, you know, if you're under 30, you're getting a huge chunk of your current news and information from TikTok, and you're not clicking on links on Facebook anymore or even on Twitter. So this multiple things have happened in this environment. All of them militate against the publishing of news and particularly the publishing of text-based news.
Publishers are moving onto those platforms, aren't they? And like Vice has moved onto those platforms completely now, hasn't it? Albeit, you know, a smaller, much smaller number of people. But those aren't great platforms for publishers, I guess, if you're writing text-based news stories.
Yeah, and there are a lot of stories that you can't really tell with video. A lot of politics stories don't lend themselves to video. A lot of, you know, law and order stories don't have video that goes with them. If you're reporting from the courts, particularly in Britain, you've got no video. Or the video is very boring to look at, you know. And these platforms have taught us very early on that just trying to replicate TV news on TikTok is a complete waste of time. Like having a reporter stand at a location with a microphone and then read the news to you is not a compelling format on TikTok. And all of these video platforms favor very short content, you know, like 30 seconds. I don't know how you're supposed to do a report about what's happening in Gaza in 30 seconds of video and have it be meaningful and real and important and nuanced and balanced and all of the rest of the, you know, reliability things that journalists are supposed to bring to these things. Yeah, so the very medium, the very format of it militates against news in some ways.
So to bring things up to date, you've done an article that will be out at the same time as this podcast about like another wave of disruption, as if we needed it, which is the sort of retail advertising, which is big in the US and growing in the UK. You just talk us through that a little bit in terms of what's going on. So, because over the last few years, Press Gazette has talked a lot about the duopoly. So Alphabet and Meta taking all the ad revenue. I mean, they still take most of the ad revenue in the UK. I reckon around at least £15 billion in ad revenue in the UK, those two, compared to news brands, about a billion. So they're about 15 times bigger than all the news brands combined. But there's another wave now coming through. So talk us through that, Jim.
Sure. So you have to sort of bear in mind the journey we're on, which is it's over 10 years at this point. But, you know, in 2014, publishers of various kinds, including news publishers, but, you know, anyone on the web who had a website, they took the vast majority of online advertising dollars, something like 71% of online advertising dollars just went on websites, basically. That is now down to less than 30%. And the vast majority of the remainder is taken by Google and Facebook. Okay. Now, for years, news publishers have lived, well, certainly in the last 10 years, have lived in this universe where Meta and Google take the majority of online advertising dollars and the publishers take the rest. And until recently, that was okay because the pie was still growing. And although the publishers were getting a smaller and smaller share of it, the actual number of dollars they were receiving was still growing. But that too is now going into decline. And that's because publishers are being squeezed by this third force, which is called, well, the term of art is retail media, but basically it's Amazon. And then in America, a small number of very large retailers, including Walmart and Target. And again, this is something that the pandemic changed. But basically, advertisers were like, well, I don't want to advertise on, you know, the New York Times or CNN because it's just doom and gloom with all these people dying. And they found that if they put their ad dollars into Amazon or Walmart, like right on the site, so that when you go to Amazon and you search for shoes, you will get a set of organic results from Amazon showing you shoes that you might be interested in, but you'll also get a bunch of paid ads that you have to sift through. And a lot of advertisers were like, well, this is great because we're advertising in front of people who are already shopping, who are about to buy. And if we pay a little bit of money to convert them, this is a very good business for us. The other thing about retail media is on Walmart and Target and Amazon, there's no bad news. You know, there's no Putin. No one's getting assassinated. You know, there's no culture war. So it completely avoids that whole sort of advertising blacklist issue. The attribution for advertisers, you know, did this ad lead to this click that led to someone buying something? That's a lot closer for them on retail media. And advertisers are not stupid. They're going to place their ad dollars where they work. The thing that really worries me on behalf of the news publishing business is that historically, this kind of retail advertising, this was a newspaper business, you know, and particularly in the United States, a Sunday newspaper would be, even a local Sunday newspaper, like when I started in the business, the local Sunday newspaper at the Torrington Register Citizen, which is a tiny little local newspaper, the Sunday edition would be like 3 inches thick. And 2.5 inches of that were supermarket coupons, you know, just in massive magazines and books. And you would cut out the coupons you wanted and take them to your local shop and get money off. And this was how advertising worked. And then the internet came along and those retailers moved their ads very often to news websites. And that was still a business for news people. And now I think that that business, those kinds of dollars are moving away from news entirely. So the whole thing has been completely disintermediated and it's going direct to Amazon and direct to Walmart and direct to Target and a small number of other platforms. TikTok actually notably is starting to take real ad dollars right now.
Yeah. So if you're Amazon, you kind of got your cake and it's like cakeism, isn't it? You've got your cake and you're eating it. You're selling people stuff and then you're also selling adverts to the people who are selling stuff on your platform and you're making money always.
Hi, I'm Anoush and I host the New Statesman podcast. Twice a week, we get under the skin of Westminster to help understand what's going on and what's going to happen next. We interview politicians, policymakers, and people on the front line to get you the full story behind the headlines. Plus, hear from our award-winning editorial team, including political editor Andrew Marr, to get to the bottom of what on earth is happening. Listen to the New Statesman podcast. You can subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
So I guess that's a sort of good summary of the scene, which is sort of getting increasingly frosty for the ad-funded journalism on the open web, I guess, you know, broadly speaking. You know, paywalls are working, other events are working, you know, other things are working for publishers. So, but in terms of ad-funded journalism on the open web, the thing that used to scrutinise democracy to the mass of people is kind of under threat, really, like never before. So with your sort of consultant hat on, and this is a tough question, Jim, but what are the sort of things that you might say to a publisher who phones you up and they're a bit concerned about it and they're trying to think about, you know, what to do? I know some things are out of our hands, aren't they? And there's a good case for sort of regulation, isn't there? Like a changing role of regulation. But, you know, in terms of what publishers can do, what do you think?
It is really difficult advice to give right now because, again, you know, 5 years ago, the advice would have been easy. You need a really good social media game. You need really good SEO, and you need to really have good metrics so that your newsroom can see what your readers like so that you can do more of it, and can see, importantly, what your readers are not interested in, so you can stop doing that and you just move resources towards that. And that was how it worked. And there was a good business there. That largely doesn't work because of everything we've just discussed today. It's just not the same. The problem for publishers is that there are solutions. There are a number of different opportunities and levers they can pull to build new businesses. But right now, because we're in this period of terrific change, and I cannot underline this enough, we're going through a period of crazy, wild flux in which billions and billions of ad dollars are moving out of some types of advertising and some types of publishing and moving into new forms. And it is not at all clear who's going to survive and who will not. And we're already seeing the losers, right? The Messenger went out of business. BuzzFeed News is gone. BuzzFeed itself, is that on the verge of bankruptcy? I don't know. Vice is bankrupt. It's gone. Business Insider did a ton of layoffs. It is not at all clear who the winners and the losers are. But there are a handful of things. Having a healthy subscription business is good, you know, and I appreciate there's also been a pullback in subscriptions. But if you are publishing information that is compelling enough that people are willing to pay for it, congratulations, you have done something very good. There are ceilings on subscriptions because you can persuade a person to take out one subscription. It's difficult to persuade them to take out six. And the data I've seen says that on average, ordinary people buy one new subscription. They're not buying 10. If it's business oriented or trade or professional oriented or around some kind of business niche, maybe you can get someone to buy 2, 3, 4 subs so that they can stay on top of their work. But that's something expensed through their work, and that's not going to carry over into consumers. There's getting people registered for free. You know, just saying you can read the site for free, but you have to give us your data, your name, email address, location, gender, age, et cetera, et cetera. There are ways. I mean, first party data of any kind is increasingly valuable. The more of it you can collect, the better. Historically, and you know, I remember this myself, but 10 years ago, what a publisher like Huffington Post or BuzzFeed or Business Insider, what we would know about our readers was next to nothing, really. So now knowing more, as much as you can, about your readers is incredibly important. So, you know, start collecting the emails. You can build up email lists. You can use those for marketing. You can use them for targeting. There are some of the big advertising companies who used to serve this programmatic business, like the Trade Desk and LiveRamp. They are developing alternative identities that are targetable on the internet, where you can attach data to them and pull them in a bid stream and target them a bit like the way you could with cookies. LiveRamp is developing a thing called RampID. It would love all publishers to use RampID. The Trade Desk is building one. I think it's called UID, and so on and so forth. The problem with these types of new identities is that what the industry really wants probably is like one open identity that anyone can use and anyone can target. So the demand and supply sort of coalesces around this one vast sea of anonymous identities. And the marketplace will have to shake out. And that's going to take a few years. And right now, there are like dozens, maybe hundreds of different types of first-party identities being developed. And it's not at all clear who's going to win and who's going to lose. There are some interesting so-called contextual things. So Dotdash Meredith has made a good business of this, where it basically says to advertisers, we cannot tell you who these people are on our site, but when they're looking at finance information, these are people who are right now interested in buying mutual funds. So target the categories on our website, the categories of content, and see if that's successful for you. And there, I believe Meredith just booked revenue growth in the last year.
They're the biggest US consumer news publisher, I think, aren't they? Definitely one of them.
They claim to be, and they're very big, to give them some credit. But the audiences are so volatile that, you know, next month they may not. And in the UK, Reach has an interesting experiment going on right now. They have this thing called Mantis, which again is a mechanism that categorizes all of the content on all their sites They originally developed it to make their content brand safe because they would discover things like advertisers would refuse to advertise on any page that said shooting because they were afraid of being next to a murder story. But that, of course, blocked them from all football stories. So they developed Mantis in order to sort of figure out the difference between shooting in a game and shooting in a murder, and also to figure out the difference between murder in a TV show and murder in real life. And this released a huge amount of their content back on the market, basically, to make it available for advertisers because it was safe, non-controversial, non-depressing content that advertisers previously blocked. They've now used that system as a targeting mechanism. So a bit like Dotdash Meredith, if you're an advertiser and you want to reach people who are interested in finance or holidays or romance or whatever the category is, Reach's Mantis program will have a category for you. And then they've coupled that with a recommendation system so that it's the recommender looks at your history of reading and then makes a good guess about what you might be interested in next. And they claim that this keeps you on site longer, looking at more page views and stuff like that. And Reach is offering this program to other publishers on a fee basis. So people are developing stuff. It's the problem is there are so many different solutions, like literally dozens or hundreds, and we're in such a wild period of flux. It's not clear which one publishers should bet on. And importantly, not all publishers should bet on the same thing. So for instance, the Financial Times has a really expensive paywall in front of very valuable information that is difficult for anyone else to get. They probably should not screw with that business model very much. You know, it's a lot harder for the Mirror and the Express and the folks at Reach. I can't see them putting a paywall down. You know, I know the Mail is trying it. Honestly, good luck with that. I think they might want to do something like look at what the Independent is doing, where you can read the Independent for free, but you have to register with an email address, which they then clearly use for marketing purposes, right? And the other thing the Independent has done, they've developed this sort of affiliate marketing business. So if they are reviewing a product, like a holiday package, they have an affiliate ad unit that goes in there so that you can book that exact holiday with a couple of clicks. And affiliate marketing, it's a very old tactic on the web, but it's kind of new for news publishers. And increasingly, a lot of people are, particularly in the finance category, a lot of finance websites have this kind of affiliate thing. Fortune is one of them. If you read anything about investments on Fortune, halfway through that story, you're going to see a big box with all of the top finance brands for whatever product you're looking at. And it'll sort of give them a ranking and rating and tell you the interest rate difference between them all. And with a couple of clicks, you can go through and open your account with one of them. And Fortune gets, it's not a kickback, that's an unfair way of looking at it, but you know, they take a cut. Right, or they take a fee based on that.
There's a few things bubbling out there, aren't there? I suppose what I wonder is whether anything is going to work without the help of these platforms. So Google and Apple control every mobile device, don't they, in the world? So you know, it's difficult to reach people without their okay. Without them helping you in some way. And then Microsoft is increasingly sort of controlling the B2B market with LinkedIn. And then, you know, Amazon have got retail. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, whether some regulation comes along in the sense that, you know, Apple and Google are maybe somehow kind of better regulating the terms of trade, I suppose, so that everyone has a fair crack of the whip. Do you think what's happened to the news industry is fair in a way? It's just we're not as good at providing an audience as TikTok, or do you think it's unfair in a way because these platforms have got a kind of unfair advantage?
I mean, I hate to say it because I remember at the time when I first used to hear Rupert Murdoch complaining that Google was taking everyone's content for free. And Google's defense was, well, we only show you a few words and then we give you a link. So in fact, we're not taking it. I think history is going to show that Murdoch was basically right about this. These platforms have taken all of the content for free. They've ingested it or scraped it all in some way to boost their own algorithms. And then although their algorithm is the product that they monetize, they've trained it and it only works because the news industry gave them a ton of content for free and never really did anything about it, with the exception of, I think, Australia and Canada, where there was some regulation. This issue is coming to a head massively with AI, because these AI large language models, ChatGPT, Gemini, they are ingesting the entire internet, and they're ingesting all publishers' websites, including news publishers. And the British government has considered giving these companies an exemption to copyright to allow them to ingest the entirety of your content. I think that was actually stopped. But their claim is, you know, it's not a copyright violation because we're not literally reprinting it. We're just using it to create something else. But publishers are insane if they take that lying down, because what you have published is your main asset. What you have got on your website is your main asset. Your archive plus today's news, that is the entire, that's your entire business. It's where all your revenues come from. So if you sell that or give that away free, if you give that away free to an AI bot, or even if you sell it at less than 100% revenues to an AI bot, you're absolutely screwing up. And I was having a conversation with a client a while back, and this guy made the case. He was like, that you can tell that publishers are terrible at technology generally, and they are. This is the thing. Publishers are taking a knife to a gunfight here. You know, all of the best software engineers, they go to TikTok or Google or Facebook. They're not coming to work at localnewspaper.com. In the music business, they invented digital rights management, so it becomes very, very difficult to copy a song or to distribute a song for free. In the movie business, digital rights management. It's very, very difficult to watch a pirated version of a movie. You can do, but it's a terrible experience. And generally, you know, give Netflix $7. It's, you know, it's just easier. Editorial never did that. We never did digital rights management on news or text-based stories of any kind. We just never bothered, which is ironic because in theory, doing DRM on text would be a lot easier than doing it on video or music. But we've just never bothered to do it. No one has developed it. No one has developed a way to publish a story that everyone can look at, but that cannot be stolen. So, I mean, that's how far behind we are. We don't even have DRM in the news business. And so we're technologically in news publishing, the year is like 2002, something like that.
Yeah, but I suppose so, and to draw to a bit of a conclusion, there was a time we thought, well, the music industry is completely over because of Napster. Yeah, that was it. Now, fast forward, music industry is okay. Similar to, I think, the book publishing industry as well, we sort of worried at a time, we thought, well, this is all just going to be pirated and given away for free. Oh, no, hang on. People still buy books, you know, quite a lot. So I suppose, is it possible that the current creative destruction might result in something good, in the sense that we assert our copyright for the first time with the AI companies? The New York Times wins its litigation. So that would be interesting. And if we were to sort of assert our copyright properly over news collectively for the first time, and publishers were somehow able to get their act together collectively, might they be in a much stronger position in the future, in the sense that they might be able to say, okay, we're you know, 1,000 plus, you know, leading publishers of the world, English language speaking world, who wants to have our content, you know, Apple or Google? You know, we're not going to give it to both of you. And I imagine for Apple or Google, having the monopoly on professional content on their devices would be a very nice selling point for them. You know, people spend a lot of time on their devices sort of scrolling through stuff. So anyway, that's just a little bit of a thought experiment, I suppose. But what do you think? Do you think there's an opportunity here for something good to come out of all this? Publishers could get their act together and maybe get the industry on a more solid footing for like the next, you know, whatever, the next 20 years?
Yeah, I think there's a few bright spots. I think AI is going to be enormously disruptive because a lot of consumers will just be perfectly happy having their news summarized by a robot and not coming direct from a real source. But I think that will actually make it valuable if you can say to your readers, actually, the people who produced this are real humans, and we have checked this with the original source of the information. And having that real distinction that you did something in reality and didn't just have the robot do it, that might become a really important brand differentiation, in much the same way that having first-party data versus trying to, you know, build a market on the open web with anonymous users, you know, first-party data is now becoming really much more valuable than it used to be. Maybe having being a human in the future may become more valuable than being artificially intelligent. So that's one thing I'm kind of hopeful about. Another thing is there's a lot of interesting stuff happening on Substack. So if you look at The Ankler, this is Janice Min's Hollywood trade publication. She has 7 employees and a revenue run rate of 10 million. And Substack as a CMS, as a publisher, provides them with a website, provides them with an email, and it also provides them with a CMS. And for that, it takes 10% of their revenues. Now, if you go to most large news publishers and say, hey, what percentage of your operating expenses or what percentage of your revenues are spent maintaining your website and your tech stack? I talked to this source at a large, famous London-based news publisher actually this morning. And he said, guess how many people we have maintaining our website? And I was like, I don't know how many. He's like, there's about 1,000 people in the tech department. I was like, 1,000? Like, if you came to me and said, I've got an idea for a successful news publisher, it will be dominant in its field and it will have big revenues and be profitable. The downside is I have to find 1,000 software engineers to work in news publishing. I'd just say, no, that's crazy. I don't want that. It's too difficult and it's too expensive. But Substack is right there and they'll do it for just 10% of your revenues, which is enormously generous. Actually, it's less than 10% of your revenues because they take 10% of your subscriptions, but they let you put advertisers and sponsors on your stuff for free. And there's a few of these, you know, the Free Press, the Barry Weiss's thing. She has a sizable newsroom now. Like, that thing is rolling, you know, and there's a few of these guys. Not all of them will win, but some of them will. I do wonder if Substack will turn out to be the new WordPress for everyone.
So a lot to unpack there from Jim. Hopefully it's not too depressing. Hopefully there are some grounds for optimism there. And as I always say, churn, creative disruption, creative destruction even, can be quite unsettling to live through. But there's always lots of opportunities to, and we saw that in 2008, the economic sort of collapse, which felt like the end of the world for journalism at the time. But here we are, 2024, still in there fighting, and there were lots of interesting things that came out of that. And arguably, the journalism world is a much more interesting place today than it was then, even if there is a bit less money around. So anyway, if you want to keep on top of all these issues, I think it's worthwhile to sign up to our newsletters. That's the best way to make sure you don't miss any stories. So on pressgazette.co.uk, sign up for our online newsletters. And of course, I think you can subscribe to this podcast, like it and recommend it to your friends. You've been listening to The Future of Media Explained with me, Press Gazette Editor-in-Chief, Dominic Ponsford, with Jim Edwards on the podcast Sofa, produced, as usual, by Suze Cooper. Thanks very much for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.